whenever I walk out on stage, if it's an audience that doesn't know me at all, especially if I'm like opening for another big artist or something like that, you can almost hear a collective like, because people see the cello and they think classical music, they think stuffy, they think somewhat sleepy maybe, and so I'll start with something somewhat classical sounding, and then I'll start singing. Well, it's a long, hard road, and you can kind of feel the shock in the room. They're like, oh, he's singing with the cello. And then after a few songs, people are grooving along, and they're like, I'm dancing to a singing cello. What's happening in the world? So that is fun. That are just too hard to forget.
This week on the show, singing cellist Ben Soley, whose music is, if I can say, easy to jam to. During this episode, Ben talks about the unsophisticated reason he picked up a highly sophisticated musical instrument. Ben also explains how he is able to bring such a unique, diverse sound to the instrument and shares some memorable moments as a musician. Ben closes the show discussing and performing a song he wrote about a Paducah vessel. This is Something From Nothing. I'm Justin Lewis. Stay tuned. Support for Something From Nothing comes from Taylor Group PLLC at 15th and Jefferson in Paducah. For both businesses and individuals, Taylor Group works with clients to achieve financial viability in the present while being proactive for future goals. More about their services at taylorgroupplc.com. A community-minded accounting firm, they also have an appreciation for the creative process and the individuals involved. Ben's interest in the cello came from public school. He was about 9 years old, and he describes his introduction to the instrument as an in-class petting zoo. The orchestra teacher showed kids in third grade some instruments, and after playing a violin and viola.
And then she showed us the cello. And when she played it, to my recollection, it sounded like bodily noises. And I was just really excited about making fart noises in class.
So you first picked up the instrument because it made not beautiful sounds, but funny sounds.
Yep, that's exactly right. I was less interested. I did, a lot of origin stories of like great classical musics come when they, hear some great recording of Horowitz or, Yo-Yo Ma, like playing these things. But I've never had that moment where I heard somebody else's sound. And thought, oh my God, I've got to make that sound. It was much more about having fun making the sound and seeing what came out of an object.
That interest in different types of sounds coming out of an object was fostered as he was growing up with it. At school, he was being trained to play classical music, but at home, he was getting experience playing completely different sounds.
My mom sang, and my dad was an R&B guitar player. And I'd sit down and jam with them.
Then he'd go back to school and play classical music and return home and play some R&B with his dad, jam with his friends, and then to add even more variety to the sounds his stringed instrument made.
Some weekends I would go stay with my grandfather, who was a fiddler, Appalachian musician in East Kentucky, and his name was Elvis Henry Cornelius. And he would teach me fiddle tunes on what he called my bull fiddle.
Simply put, Ben would describe his experience growing up in Kentucky, playing the cello this way.
My teachers really didn't have time for me for fiddle tunes, and Grandpa didn't play Brahms. It was a cool place to grow up, and I think that a huge part of my identity as a musician is tied to being from Kentucky, because I don't know where else you would grow up as a cellist and have classical music and R&B and bluegrass really not just be something that you listen to or into, but like be part of your family identity.
Ben, in an attempt to bring all his Kentucky influences together, became a songwriter early. He said he started in his teens, probably around 14 or 15. He recalled that many of his early songs had a Dave Matthews sound to them. He was into pop music as well, but it didn't take long for him to really find his own voice. His first album, recorded as a teenager, remember, was called Just Plain Ben.
If anybody has a copy of it out there, I'll be happy to buy a pack from you.
He recorded this experimental album in his parents' basement.
And it features a lot of me banging on paint cans and various homemade instruments and writing my own songs. And I believe, that record exists.
His second record that exists was one he wrote as he was graduating high school. He also offered to buy that one back. It was after recording his third record when he turned the corner. This one got recognition from networks and was distributed around. It sort of put Ben on the map and gave him some opportunities to tour. He was starting to build his name. Then, in 2008...
I put out this record, Learning to Bend, and it was received wonderfully. Got amazing press, you know, NPR, All Things Considered. Mm-hmm. Really just a wonderful push. And then the stock market just completely collapsed. Mm-hmm. And for a while, it was cool. Like, I traveled around the country, and, you know, every show was sold out. And then I went back 6 months later to those same communities, and, like, no one came. Because people realized they didn't have money. Mm-hmm. And so... now, sitting in this chair at age 35, looking back at that release and just seeing, like, the curve of the economy and how that matched the curve of my career, especially trying to do something different and unique as a singing cellist, is really interesting to reflect on. Like, the fact that I've been able to make a career at all, when so many of my friends really tipped their hats and said, yeah, see ya, really, I think, is a real privilege.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think not taking the advice of some of my professors and moving to New York or LA or even Chicago or Nashville, because those are the places that inspire me. Mm-hmm. I like visiting them, but that's not what I write my music about. Mm-hmm. It's not the landscape or the people that I tend to write about. And so staying in Kentucky allowed me to stay inspired and keep a low standard of, you know, low cost way of living. Which meant I could make the art that I wanted to make, not the art that I needed to make. So that definitely helped, keeping a low overhead. And then I think kind of learning what I learned from growing up on Woodsongs, Old Time Radio Hour in Lexington. Mm-hmm. I played on some 200 broadcasts as part of the stage band for that and met so many great artists, and I heard their interviews and their songs, and then of course all the backstage conversation, and some of them actually would kind of give me some mentoring advice here and there. And, you know, by the end of that, I understood deeply that, you know, if you're going to make a music deal out there in the world, make sure it's a good human deal or don't do it, because, you know, the value of your music grows over time, and this is something that most young artists don't learn until they've already signed everything away. And I chose not to do that. I ran my own record label, and I owned my own catalog, and kind of facilitated all that stuff. So that also was really helpful, as I maintained my own music, and so I benefited from the value of it as it grew. So some business stuff, some smart business choices, some lucky breaks here and there, and then just making sure that I kept my overhead low are the reasons that I was able to keep a career going.
And there's not a lot of singing celloists. Does that contribute to the kind of the, I don't know the right word here, cachet, unique, set yourself apart kind of piece of that?
I think certainly from a press standpoint, people are like, oh, that feels different than another, you know, typically singer-songwriter guy with a guitar. I'll write about that. But the other edge of that sword is that, you know, people hear about it and don't know whether that's something they want to go see. Yeah. So really, you got to get people to see it. And then hopefully they like it. A lot of people end up liking it. And then you need to come back now that they decided so they can bring their friends. So it's a lot of touring. And, of course, in this day and age, I think I'm at a place where I know what it would take to, you know, gear my career up as a musician to another stage, and it would mean a lot of time on the road, which, I, you know, for me is not sustainable environmentally, emotionally, physically, and I think so I've made a pivot of recent to be more local.
Ben is a very environmentally minded individual. He said he was tired of just talking about environmental impact and took an action in his life to make a change.
I just couldn't justify. I tried to mitigate it in different ways. I did music tours by bicycle. We called them ditch the van tours, right? Where I put the cello on the bicycle and traveled around the country. We did over 5,000 miles of touring around the country, hauling our own gear. We tried. We tried more environmentally friendly ways of touring. You know, really awesome, fun experience. But it was twice the time for half the money.
Right.
So economically, not so great. Yeah. But it also isn't as expensive to do either. It's just, you know, time is money at the end of the day. And with a family, I have two beautiful children. My son's 11, Oliver, and my daughter, Clara May, is 17 months. I really feel like just being on the road, traveling that long a period of time to play that number of shows doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. At least not now. Yeah. Later in my life, when, you know, financially independent and kids aren't relying on me to bring in some money, maybe I'll just take my time and tour by a bicycle. But right now, it doesn't make sense.
At the time of our interview, Ben was in Paducah for a show. But when he comes to town, it isn't just a concert, then load up the gear and leave. For example, this is his second time in Paducah, and he likes to participate in what he calls micro residencies. Activities involved in this include things like visiting the local elementary school, writing a song about a historic building that's currently being renovated. Ben even played music during yoga at an art museum. He said he was really able to take in a community and feel like he has made an impact when he leaves town. Where did you get that idea?
Well, I mean, it's a very old school way of touring. You know, when Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys were touring, they didn't just pull into town and play a show at the club. They pulled into town. They went to church. They arm wrestled people and fought people. They went and stopped by the bar. They made sure that everybody knew they were playing in town. And by the time they got done, everybody knew that that was a show that you had to go to. Mm. And of course, Duke Ellington and his train tours are a fine example of, you know, pulling up into a town, dropping yourself off and playing shows. Pete Seeger, of course, really demonstrated that model where he would come in and really spend time in a place and write songs in a place and play shows and do workshops. And so my songwriting heroes and artist heroes really are people that worked on that level, that were grassroots oriented, you know, maybe at different parts of their career it was less so or more so, but they were oriented towards that. And did that community level work to make sure that their art was having an impact and that that place was having an impact on their art.
Ben shared impactful moments on his art with me. On one occasion, he found himself playing with
a group of Mongolian musicians in China. They were this band called Hongai, and the leader of the band or the lead songwriter of the band had this kind of really cool young Bob Dylan vibe about him, was constantly smoking cigarettes and kind of lanky, and you know, he would sing in this like just incredible low tones, but kind of in a weird, again, Bob Dylan-esque vibe. But the rest of the instruments in the band were for the most part traditional Mongolian instruments. So you had the what's in Mandarin is the Ma Ti Chen, which is equivalent to the cello, the horse head cello. And then they had kind of an oud type instrument or a saz type instrument that kind of played the role of the guitar. And then they had a mouth harp that was, you know, tuned really low. So they would play the mouth harp and kind of chant along with it. And they had this kind of dirge, like folk metal vibe to it that was amazing. And so getting up there and playing music with them was epic.
Epic in a different way was a time he was playing with Otis Taylor.
And we were playing in Wheeling, West Virginia, right on the river there, and a storm came up behind us as we were playing. And for folks that know Otis's music, they'll know that it kind of has this trance, African, somewhat voodoo quality to it. And we were playing a song called Black Witch. Mm-hmm. And we just had this incredible, like, deep groove, like Afro groove going on. And the storm just comes barreling across the mountainside. So, because it's a deep river valley there, so you don't see it. And then suddenly it's on you. And and just beautiful cathedral lighting, lightning all over, just kind of cascading around. And of course, everything got shut down really quick, and the sky zipped open and just dumped rain. And it felt like the music had called the rain.
He also mentioned a jam in Nashville that grew and grew with accomplished musicians such as
Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings, John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin, Sarah Watkins, Abigail Washburn, Bela Fleck.
But this jam was most memorable because of the least known musician, but one that is more important to impress.
The other person that was in the circle was actually my father-in-law, who's an amateur mandolin picker, and he'd come down to visit. He was sitting in the circle picking, and Bela was playing, and, you know, right beside John Paul, and everybody's into it, and they kind of look up across the way and nod towards Garrett, my father-in-law, and Garrett kind of looks around and puts his chin down and just starts shredding a solo on the mandolin, which is, you know, a good solo, but by comparison to the players around, amateur. Yeah. And, you know, kind of like gets in the solo and kind of looks around and, you know, feels real good that he's done it. And then Bela, you know, re-nods to the person beside Garrett who he really meant to sing a solo. But Garrett, oh, my father-in-law, just he never lets that down. He always remembers that moment. He's like, well, I mean, I think I played pretty good solo. What did you think of my solo?
Ben closed the show by describing an example of how curiosity is a vital part of the creative process of songwriting for him.
So this is a song called Eva Kelly, and it began its life in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where I live. I was standing in a building near the river, the Muhammad Ali Center, and was on the top floor kind of looking down, and it was a time of year where there had been a lot of rain, so the river was really engorged, as you know, muddy and full of debris. And I saw this tugboat that was pushing upstream against the current, pushing, you know, I guess 8 different coal barges, and it was just really pushing hard. It was amazing because the tugboat looks so small when it's behind tow. It was amazing, and I found myself looking down there and just being like, wow, if that isn't a visual poem for the times that we're in, you know, you got this, you know, we're working so hard pushing against the tide and the current, you know, even though all these signs point towards the fact that we need to be more thoughtful about our impact on the environment, here we are just pushing against the current. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at the boat, and there on the side said her name, Eva Kelly. And so I ended up doing some internet research and getting a hold of somebody and finding out that she is docks out of Paducah. She's owned by the Krauts Corporation. And so I just called them up and said, hey, I'm a songwriter. Is there anybody there that would want to talk to me about one of your vessels? And the receptionist was very nice. She didn't have to be. And she's like, well, I don't know, but I tell you what, I'll see if someone was willing to talk to you. So about an hour later, I got a call from a nice fellow there, and we had a good conversation, a really wide-ranging conversation. I'm asking about what the boats, how they're staffed and crewed, and how long they run and how much they can push, and you know, the nature of the river and when you're on high water and the still water, and, you know, the captains and the cooks, and 21 days on and 21 days off. And we even talked about climate change. And, you know, he of course, didn't really think much of the idea of climate change, but he did recognize that they were hauling, you know, more diverse cargo these days than just coal. Mm-hmm. And so I thanked him for his time and did some more internet research about, you know, articles and people that had worked on, you know, tugboats writing about their experiences. And after a while felt like, I think I'm going to try this song. I'm going to try writing a song about the Eva Kelly. So this is what I got out of it. And of course it begins in this very like chugging, mechanical, hardworking way. Like we're building tow on the river. You know, they these guys have these huge tools, this kind of like wrench and chain tool that they call the mother and children or something like that, the mama and the child. Mm-hmm. But, you know, wife and kids, that's what they call it. They call it the wife and kids. And they, you know, are cranking, like pulling these barges together. And so it kind of has a balletic feel to me in that sort of Pina Bausch sort of way. And then the song, you know, kind of evens out into the story section where we're just chugging along, like listening to really what I think is the perspective of either somebody who operates the boats or even the captain of the boat or somebody that's just on the boat. The song's kind of really written from their perspective. So I'll play it for you now. Last time the river was this high, ooh, it washed away my faith. And it's been raining now for 2 long weeks. Oh, they're closing up the floodgates against the current and all the debris. You can set your clocks by the Eva Kelly. She's been pushing coal past every river town on the Ohio. At first light, the fog was all around. We couldn't see a thing. A distant horn blows 5 times. Ooh, there's trouble up ahead. And on the back watch, I wonder just how we could turn this old tugboat around. She's been pushing coal past every river town on the Ohio. That rich black gold, ooh, but it's drying up these days. But you can still hear her engines whine, towing stone and grain. The tides may shift and the tow might change, but I'll not work a ship by any other name. She's been pushing coal past every river town on the Ohio. Thank you.
This has been Something from Nothing, a podcast about the creative process and the individuals involved. Support for this season of Something from Nothing comes from Paducah's Taylor Group, PLLC, a community-minded accounting firm proud to support the creative process. Offering small business consultation, tax services, retirement planning, and more, Taylor Group works to help clients achieve financial viability. There's more about their services online at taylorgroupplc.com. Special thanks to Susan Beyer for giving me access to her office in McCracken County Public Library to record my interview with Ben. For more on Ben, you can find him on social media and also at bensoley.com. Something from Nothing also is on social media at Something from Nothing Podcast and on Facebook. For more episodes, check out Apple Podcast, Google Play, or WKMS.org, where all 5 seasons are available. Editing assistance for this episode was provided from German-American Stacy Reason, who hosted Ben at the Art Museum for yoga back when she lived stateside. This episode was produced by me, your host, Justin Lewis. Thanks for listening.